I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Tim Weiner has been reporting on the CIA and intelligence for the last 20 years. He got a Pulitzer Prize in 1988 for his investigative reports into secret spending by the Pentagon and CIA. That became the basis for his book, Blank Check, about the Pentagon's black budget. His new book, Legacy of Ashes, is a history of the CIA from its creation under the Truman administration to today, and it's not a pretty story. Weiner argues that the mythology about the CIA and its reputation for success are undone by many of the facts. He writes about coups orchestrated by the CIA that backfired, assassination attempts, intelligence failures, presidential misuse of the agency and misunderstanding of the mission of the agency, and critical mistakes by a series of CIA directors. Tim Weiner combed through thousands of documents, many from the CIA archives, and interviewed people inside and outside the agency, including 10 directors. Everyone is on record considered a first for a book about the CIA. And Tim Weiner joins us this morning on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Hi, Marty. Great to see you again.
What does this title refer to, Legacy of Ashes, something that Eisenhower said to Alan Dulles?
In the last days of Dwight Eisenhower's presidency, the same week he gave that famous speech about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, he gathered all the members of his National Security Council together, and he turned to Alan Dulles, his director of Central Intelligence for 8 years, and he tore his head off. And he said, Alan, I have been after you for 8 years to get Central Intelligence organized, and you have failed me. We are no better organized than we were back at Pearl Harbor. You have handed me an 8-year defeat. And I'm going to hand to my successor, John F. Kennedy, a legacy of ashes. And 4 months later came the Bay of Pigs.
Interesting. Also interesting because under the Eisenhower administration were the coups in Guatemala and Iran orchestrated by the CIA, and I'm assuming signed off on by President Eisenhower.
They came very early in those 8 years, in 53 and 54. Ike hadn't been president for more than 6 months before the Iran coup and a year and a half before Guatemala happened. And Alan Dulles sold these coups to President Eisenhower after the fact as brilliant operations, bloodless, sleight of hand, magic, really, silver bullets, when in fact they succeeded not through sleight of hand but through slaughter and violence. There was a meeting at the White House of all the CIA guys who ran the Guatemala coup. And this is all on the record in black and white. And the CIA had backed a colonel named Castillo Armas against the elected president. And I turned to one of the CIA guys and said, so how many men did Castillo Armas lose? And the CIA man said, one. Incredible, said the president. Yeah, it was incredible because it was a lie.
How many had they lost?
Quite a few dozen.
And this was called Operation Success,
it
this Guatemala
Success,
mission.
Yes.
And it was the overthrow of a government.
A duly elected president whom the United States perceived as a red menace.
And the installation of whom?
A series of military juntas that lasted for the better part of 40 years and kicked off an internal civil war in which roughly 200,000 civilians died, almost all of them at the hands of the Guatemalan military. Hmm.
You also tell a story about the ambassador to Guatemala.
Many years later, that's
many years later. This is, what, 1994 in Guatemala. The CIA apparently is taping. Go ahead. You tell it.
In 1994, we had a new policy, or thought we did, in the Western Hemisphere. The Cold War was over. And the United States was going to support human rights and a settlement to this terrible 40-year civil conflict that had killed so many thousands of people. And the new ambassador was a woman named Marilyn McAfee. And one day the CIA station chief, this is the way McAfee tells the story, and it's true, it's all documented. One day the CIA station chief says, you know, the Guatemalan military has some pretty damning information about you. Really? Said the ambassador. What is it? The CIA station chief was coy about it, but the CIA had sent up to Washington with a straight face and without commentary a transcript that the Guatemalan military had made by bugging the ambassador's bedroom and recording her making cooing noises to someone named Murphy. Oh, Murphy. Murphy, I love you. Well, the Guatemalan military went down the diplomatic list and discovered that the ambassador had a secretary, a woman named Carol Murphy, and put two and two together, got 22, and determined that the ambassador was having a love affair with her secretary. Again, this memo went up to Washington and was widely circulated by the CIA without any commentary or mention of the fact that the ambassador was happily married, heterosexual, not sleeping with her secretary, and had a two-year-old black standard poodle named Murphy, right.
Who she was making sweet nothings with and cooing to.
She was petting her dog.
Exactly.
And she was almost destroyed. And this was a conflict. This wasn't funny. This was a conflict between the foreign policy of the United States, which was based on human rights, and intelligence, as interpreted by the CIA.
But does this tell you two important stories about the CIA? On the one hand, we're talking about orchestrating a coup of a duly elected government. The other, you know, salacious taping of someone and the spreading of false rumors.
Ambassadors are supposed to run American embassies. Station chiefs work out of U.S. embassies. The State Department provides cover for them. They pose as diplomats traditionally, and then they go about their work. In a country where the foreign minister is more powerful than the interior minister or the head of the secret police, the ambassador, the American ambassador, has more power. The power structure derives from the internal politics of the host country. But if it's a tough country where the interior minister or the head of the secret police or whoever the chief son of a bitch is, the station chief has more power than the ambassador because that is the power structure of the country. And these wars between station chiefs and ambassadors have gone on ever since the CIA was created 60 years ago.
You talk about, and perhaps this is the built-in tension even within the CIA, going back to the Truman administration. On the one hand, there was espionage, as you say, you know, wanting to know about the world. And then there was covert action, as you say, efforts to change the world, and the kind of built-in tension between those two missions of the CIA.
The opening line of this book is, all Harry Truman wanted was a newspaper. Granted, all journalism is autobiography, but all he really wanted was a newspaper. That's true. And the original mission of the CIA was about information, all about information. The job was to keep the president currently informed on what's going on in the world, provide strategic warning of the threat of another Pearl Harbor, should it arise, and finally, to provide the President and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense with information that they needed to put together a strategy for the United States. Not for tomorrow, not for next week, but over the horizon for 3 years to come. Strategic intelligence. And Marty, we haven't done that for so long, we don't even know what it is anymore.
Well, and I'm assuming also keeping an eye on the Soviet Union, because after the Second World War, we're talking about the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, very quickly after World War II, the CIA was formed in 1947, in large part to prevent a second Pearl Harbor, but also to get the president information about what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, a phrase that first was used in 1946. The United States and the Soviet Union were the two countries that emerged from World War II as superpowers, and even though the Soviets had lost 20 million dead in the war, and we had lost 300,000, they were indeed a superpower, and frankly, we wouldn't have beaten Hitler without them.
No, go ahead.
But Joseph Stalin, their leader, was a dictator, a murderer, and he had designs on Western Europe, Central Europe, and Eastern Europe. And it was a job of the CIA very quickly to fight fire with fire through covert action, to do something. This was the great catchphrase of the day, do something about the threat of an expanding Soviet Union, to roll them back.
So the people whose job was to gather intelligence kind of lost out to the covert action people?
You can't even call it a power struggle.
There's no contest?
Covert action, that is the impulse to change history, to change the world rather than know the world, quickly gained the upper hand at CIA. It won by 1948, after the first full year of the agency's life, and it kept it for a quarter century.
I got the feeling early on that the people recruited, hired for the CIA were the kind of, you know, blue bloods of their time. They went to all the proper boarding schools. Yes, no, you're shaking your head.
Well, there's a myth about the CIA. There are many. And it is true that many of the prominent figures went to Groton and to Yale and, you know, knew which
that
salad
trajectory.
Fork to use and all that good stuff. And that's a myth that has some basis in reality. But in fact, the best CIA officers of that first generation that ran from the late 40s through the 60s were the kinds of people the Soviets used to call rootless cosmopolitans. They'd been born abroad. They'd been born in Bucharest or Budapest or Berlin or even behind the Iron Curtain. And they spoke many languages, and they knew history and culture, and they knew how to get around Vienna, you know, the back alleys of Vienna in 9 different languages. And those guys were the really best spies, and some of them stayed on for 25 and 30 years and wound up as the station chief in Saigon or the chief of Soviet espionage. And their names were not Thaxter, Baxter, Hatcher. You know, they didn't have 3 last names and a Roman numeral after them.
Well, and interesting, we're almost up on our first break here, is it seems that what the CIA sorely needs today are those people that speak all those languages and know the back alleys of various cities and can talk to people.
It is a striking fact that the CIA today, 6 years after 9/11, is the youngest, weakest, least experienced workforce it has ever had. Half the workforce has less than 5 years experience. They are newbies. They are trainees by the CIA's own standards. They are not good to go. This is a really dangerous state of affairs.
And that's because people have retired or left the agency?
And because the president ordered the CIA to expand its ranks by 50%. 50% of who?
And you're saying the people, they just don't have the experience, the knowledge, to do the kind of work that you think the CIA needs to do today?
They don't have the language abilities, they don't have the country experience, and by and large, they have never been to the places that we're interested about.
Well, tell you what, we are going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation. Tim Weiner is our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Legacy of Ashes, and it's a history of the CIA. He's been covering intelligence in the CIA for some 20 years now. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He spent some time here in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. This fall, continuing education programs at the Academy offer studio art courses and workshops in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking for all ages and levels of experience, from beginner to advanced. Conveniently scheduled during weekdays, evenings, and weekends with Saturday courses for high school students and teachers. 215-972-7632 or PAFA.edu. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY.
This Week in This American Life. Okay, there's a war in Iraq. Nobody's been able to end it. But Dahl? He thought he was the man for the job.
I, Dahl Emanuel, who's just an American citizen, I'm tired of trying to convince someone else to do something, to get someone else to do it, to do it. I'm just going to do it myself.
Dahl goes to Baghdad this week.
Wednesday night at 10 o'clock on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A reporter takes a nuclear power plant road trip across America. Is this industry about to be reborn? Also, the view from the Arab world. A behind-the-scenes look at this popular program from Cairo and Beirut. It's based on America's The View. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tim Weiner. He's got a new book. It's called Legacy of Ashes, and it's a history of the CIA. Calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm thinking, and we're going back and forth in time as we talk about the CIA over the last 60 years, but the critical need today for people who speak another language, probably an Arabic language, in order to be able to understand the world that we live in.
Or Chinese, or Chinese, Korean,
exactly.
Or Farsi. Let me tell you a story about when Bob Gates, our current Secretary of Defense, ran the CIA about 15 years ago. Gates wanted to hire a guy from Azerbaijan, an American citizen who spoke Azeri. That's Azerbaijan is just a little north of Iran, critical country in the jigsaw puzzle of that part of the world. And he came to find out that the CIA's hiring people wouldn't hire the guy because he didn't do well on the written English test. And Gates told me the story. He blew a gasket. And he said, "What have you done? I've got thousands of people in this place who can speak English. I don't have a single person who can speak Azeri." He thought the hiring practices of the CIA were insane is a slightly strong word, but guaranteed that you weren't going to get people who were a little different, people who maybe didn't play in the sandbox well with others, people who looked a little funny, but above all, people who didn't look like they just got off the bus from Kansas and were therefore unlikely to be able to walk in the back alleys of Pyongyang or walk through an Arab bazaar or haggle in an African market.
You write, actually talk about and interviewed many of the CIA directors, including Gates. How would you rate his tenure as head of the CIA?
Well, it was certainly brief. It lasted only 14 months. But I have to say, during those 14 months, which were from November 1991 to January 1993, things ran pretty smoothly. Why? Even though there were crises galore going on
including
in the world.
Including the Persian Gulf War. Was that,
well,
that
was a little
period
after. And the fall of the Soviet Union, the complete death of Soviet communism, newly emerging republics, and the United States kept its powder dry. Why? Well, you had running the CIA the only career analyst who ever rose to the top, and you had running the country the only president who'd ever run the CIA, and that was George Herbert Walker Bush. And so the line of understanding was clear there in a way that it's never been in the last 60 years. Not one president, with the exception of George Bush the Elder, has understood the slightest thing about the CIA and its secret operations, and that gets us in a lot of trouble. Okay? They want silver bullets, presidents do. They want solutions yesterday. And espionage, that is the slow, patient gathering of secrets, takes years. Presidents don't like that.
But you also say that a number of CIA directors wanted to please their boss and give them the information that they thought would reflect well on them. And then underscoring that is all the misinformation, even in some cases disinformation, given to a president by a CIA chief.
The CIA is the president's outfit. It derives its power from the president. And when the CIA goes in and tells presidents things that he doesn't want to hear, he gets mad. Mm-hmm. And that creates problems. Now, the most recent grave disaster of the famous 2000 estimate that told the president and the world that there was a huge arsenal of chemical and biological weapons in Iraq, the CIA didn't do that to please the president. We have to be very clear about that. They didn't do that to curry favor with the White House. They did that because that's what their intelligence told them, and unfortunately they didn't tell us, that their intelligence was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and they didn't have the foggiest idea what was going on in Iraq.
And why not?
Because they didn't have any spies.
And by spies, you mean, I mean literally people on the ground, the kind of people you were describing earlier.
Either Americans or foreign agents who were working for the United States and had the faintest notion what Saddam did or did not have in his arsenal. And how do you think the president and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense felt when we went to war and the case for war that had been developed by the CIA, the grave and gathering threat of this immense arsenal, turned into sand? They were furious.
I wonder, though, and I have to say, using that example and also reading your book, it seems that this is part of a pattern where the CIA gets information that's either outdated, incorrect, or completely bogus, and passes that information on to a president. I wonder whether, is that the CIA's fault? Is that the president's fault?
This is an American problem. This is not the CIA's problem. This is an American problem. Why don't we understand what's going on in the world, Marty? Because we don't speak the language. We don't speak Arabic. We don't speak Chinese or Korean or Pashto, the language they speak in eastern Afghanistan, or Farsi, the language of Iran. And so, because we don't speak the language, we rely on spy satellites, which stare down at the world, and electronic eavesdropping equipment, which listens in on the world. But if you have no idea what people are saying, that's not very useful. And so we wind up buying our intelligence from, quote, friendly, unquote, foreign intelligence services. And Marty, there are no friendly foreign intelligence services. Nations don't have friends. They have interests. So the Jordanians tell us what we want to hear, and the Israelis tell us what we want to hear, and so on and so forth, and we wind up getting a skewed picture of what's really going on in the world, which gets us into a hell of a lot of trouble.
And I do want to start taking some calls here, but it is interesting to, and depressing, frankly, to talk about the various things that the CIA missed. For instance, the fall of the Soviet Union.
Oops.
The Hungarian uprising.
Too bad.
The Korean War.
Yep.
The Soviet A-bomb. I mean, the list goes on and on.
When intelligence fails, soldiers die. That's what it boils down to.
But who, you know, if you make a colossal blunder like that, who's responsible? I mean,
the president, ultimately the president.
I mean, if that's the boss.
It's his outfit.
Meaning that he hires, fires.
No, he commands and controls it. He chooses the director, and he tells it what to do. Ever since the Bay of Pigs in 1961, the CIA has been exquisitely sensitive to presidential command and control. It does what the president tells it to do.
Tim Weiner, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the CIA, and that's what his new book is about. It's called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He spent about a decade here in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Joe from West Philadelphia to join us. Joe, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
I have a question for you about after 9/11. I noticed that both Woolsey, former secretary, former head of the CIA, and George Bush the senior got on the TV at some point, and they seemed to be chatting, saying the same message. And one of the phrases they use is, "How can we do our job if our hands are tied?" And it seemed like they were really pushing, or maybe they were covering for the CIA's lapse, but also asking for a rollback of more civil rights or whatever in order for them to be able to do more effective work.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Your thoughts, Tim Weiner.
We have been trying for 60 years in this country to figure out how to run a secret intelligence service in an open American democracy. We have not succeeded yet.
You think it's possible?
I don't think we have any choice. We're a superpower. We project our power overseas. That's what superpowers do. To look over the horizon, you need intelligence to anticipate surprise. Presidents don't like surprises. And again, when intelligence fails, war happens. The Korean War happens. Vietnam happens. Iraq happens. And 9/11 happens. Mm.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Dee from the Art Museum area in Philadelphia. Hi, Dee. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My question has to do with the way that the government doesn't really take advantage of normal, everyday people. Because, you know, my father is Egyptian. He speaks Arabic fluently. And after 9/11 called, he's retired. And after 9/11 happened, he called to see if he could volunteer to be a translator. And he never got any response or any interest in, you know, having him help. And he really wanted to help. And so I'll take my answer off the air.
No, I appreciate the call, Dee. Go ahead, Tim Wine.
Sure.
Dee, is your father by any chance, are you still on the air? No, you went off.
Yeah,
okay,
no,
go ahead, Dee. Okay. Does
your father by chance have relatives living overseas in Egypt?
Yeah, but most of his family's over here.
Yeah, well, if he has a single blood relative living overseas, CIA doesn't want him.
Really?
Security risk. This is another example of how security and efficiency are two different things, something we are reminded of every time we go to an airport nowadays. The CIA's hiring practices on this point are the same kind of practices that drove Bob Gates up a wall 15 years ago when he was running the outfit. He's the Secretary of Defense today. If you are a loyal American who happens to be an Arab and living in Dearborn, Michigan, as thousands of loyal Arab Americans do, and you want to serve your country, and you have blood relatives living back in Syria or Jordan, forget about it. You won't be hired by CIA. You're a security risk. It is incredible to me at this late day and age that we are talking about language problems at CIA, which we are, believe me, they are huge. And, you know, if I ran the zoo, what I would do is set up, well, it's already set up. There's a program called the National Security Education Program. It was founded in 1991, and it was designed to educate Americans to speak those tough languages like Arabic and Chinese that pull your grade point average down. And get a 5-year education in not only the language, but the history and the culture of the countries where those languages are spoken. You know what the budget, the congressionally authorized budget for this program is today? Take a wild guess.
$10 million.
$4 million.
$4 million.
Nothing. If I ran the zoo, I would add 4 zeros to that. No, sorry, three zeros to that and make that a $4 billion a year program for 5 years. Train up 100,000 Americans in those hard languages. At the end of those 5 years, you would have something.
Hmm. Dee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Marie from South Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Marie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've heard your guest on a few different programs and enjoyed listening to him. But I'm interested in the fact that he said earlier, he essentially lays the blame for the bad intelligence about WMD solely with the CIA, saying that the President and Defense Department, et cetera, were furious and surprised. I've read some other books and other things about it, and it seems that there was another agency within the Defense Department that was analyzing its own information. I'm wondering if your guest knows anything about that or truly lays the entire blame at the feet of the CIA.
It's a great question, Marie. Go ahead, Tim.
Excellent question. There were two key members of the present administration back then who had learned 30 years before when they were serving in the Ford administration not to trust the CIA. And those people were Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney had been Secretary of Defense during the first Gulf War, and he thought the CIA's performance during the first Gulf War in 1991 was atrocious. Don Rumsfeld had been Secretary of Defense during the Ford administration in 1975 and 1976, and he too had a rather negative, putting it politely, opinion about CIA. So they set up their own bucket shops in the vice president's office and in the Pentagon, their own little CIA clones, to do what they thought the CIA was incapable of doing, which is analyzing foreign intelligence. Every president has gotten frustrated in this way and set up his own little bucket shop. It's very rare for the vice president and the secretary of defense to set up their bucket shops that produce the intelligence they want to hear. Hmm. But they did.
But the CIA also was relying on intelligence from Iraqi defectors that turned out to be wrong. I mean, it seemed like there were problems at all levels.
They only believed the information from Iraqi defectors that fit their preconceptions.
Mm-hmm. And just to fill in a little bit of history here, you also talk about a CIA-backed coup, in Iraq in 1963, installing the Ba'ath Party.
Right. It was a black and white world during the Cold War. You were Furs or Guinness. And the United States, installed a number of tin horn dictators around the world. And in Iraq, there had been a coup against the king, who was very pro-American, in 1958. And we wanted to get, we the United States government, wanted to get somebody in there who was more likely to do our bidding. So the CIA, and this is under President Kennedy, by the way,
right,
backed the Ba'ath Party. And as one of their ministers said during the 1960s, we came to power on a CIA train. And one of the passengers on that train was an up-and-coming young assassin named Saddam Hussein.
Hmm. Talking about Kennedy and talking about the assassination of Diem, as you seem to indicate in this book, I think people would be maybe surprised, maybe shocked, maybe not, to know that the president appeared to order the assassination of Diem, who was the president of South Vietnam.
Here was a country we were trying to back and had been backing for a decade, South Vietnam. And we got tired of the president named Diem. He was ineffective, his brother was corrupt, and things weren't going as swimmingly as we thought they should in South Vietnam. And so the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, in a very offhand, careless way, authorizes the overthrow of the leader of the country that we're trying to support, President Diem. He was overthrown. The generals and colonels who overthrew him knew that the United States was backing them, and they had a high-ranking CIA officer in their camp, not to pull the trigger, but to sort of keep an eye on them, which is legitimate. The Kennedys do not come off well in this book, Legacy mm-hmm. of Ashes. They come off as people, it's like that wonderful line from The Great Gatsby about Nick and Daisy. Tom and Daisy,
right.
Buchanan. Tom and Daisy were careless. These guys were careless with lives, and it is a stain on the family escutcheon that will not out.
And part of, I guess, a history, as you say in this book, of and again going back to the Cold War, of supporting use fascists to fight communists.
Well, look, we all forget what the Cold War was like. It lasted 45 years. It was fought in every nation on Earth. And it was a black and white world. There weren't any neutralists in the eyes of the United States. And so some pretty unsavory characters got the backing of the United States. And presidents authorized the CIA to do some very unsavory things in their names. And, you know, the story of Legacy of Ashes is what the pointed end of the spear of American foreign policy looks like.
That's Tim Weiner, our guest today on Radio Times, taking another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And we are talking about his new book called Legacy of Ashes. It's a history of the CIA. He's a reporter for the New York Times and joins us today on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival brings Doc Watson, Mavis Staples, Sam Bush, Sun Volt, David Bromberg, Angel Band, Jonathan Edwards, and more to the Old Pool Farm in Schwenksville, PA for 3 days of folk music and dance, August 17th through 19th. A weekend of concerts, camping, and kids' activities. The Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 17th through 19th. Details 1-800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
On The Next Fresh Air, actor Paul Rudd talks about his experiences making Knocked Up, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and Anchorman. He stars in the new film, The Ten. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for The Next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
next time on Day to Day.
We'll take a fast ride down to the beach.
It's easy to see how a nuclear power plant has transformed Seabrook, New Hampshire.
The town put in a sewer system, town hall, recreation center, a new library.
Though some changes are more welcome than others.
It's not Seabrook anymore, the small fishing village. You know, they think of it as the nuke town.
Living next door to a nuke plant, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Tim Weiner, our guest, he's a reporter for the New York Times. He's won the Pulitzer Prize twice, and he's got a new book called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me talk to you about the treatment of detainees at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, as we understand it. The rendition program where the CIA, apparently with the cooperation of some countries around the world, have access to prisons, and there are allegations of mistreatment and even torture. Looking at the history of the CIA, do you see the roots of this particular behavior?
Yeah, secret prisons are nothing new. During the Korean War and the national emergency that surrounded the Korean War, the CIA had a problem, which is that it had a number of foreign agents working for it, whom it suspected were actually working for the other side, for the Soviets, or for the Communist Chinese, or for the North Koreans. And so they took these people, and they threw them into secret prisons. There was one in a Navy brig in the Panama Canal Zone, which the U.S. controlled. And there were others in the still-occupied countries of Germany and Japan. We ran these places. We could do whatever we wanted. And so we set up secret prisons to interrogate these suspected foreign agents. And the CIA used all manner of drugs and mental torture and every way, which way it could, to figure out if these guys were, in fact, double agents working for the other side. That was in the 1950s. This led to was part of a larger program, which led to a decade-long effort to try and figure out if you could control another man's mind. With LSD, speed, uppers, downers, and various other drugs in the pharmacopoeia. There was one prisoner in the federal penitentiary in Kentucky who they kept high on LSD for 77 days. End result, you cannot control another man's mind.
I mean, out of all of this, do you know whether they ever got useful information or the information that they thought they were looking for?
Yeah, they discovered that you cannot control another man's mind.
I mean, that was the result. And there was this program, the Ultra Program, I guess you're referring to that, where there were mind control experiments.
Yeah. That's the program.
You also talk about the treatment of someone named Yuri Nosenko, and perhaps that's the person you were
referring to. Same kind of problem. No. Same kind of problem, different era. A Soviet defector named Yuri Nosenko, who had worked for the KGB, came over to the United States in early 1964. And he was a genuine defector, although people argue about it to this day. And he said, among other things, you know, I saw the file on Lee Harvey Oswald. This was a Marine who had defected to the Soviet Union, then re-defected to the United States, and in early 1964 was remembered as the man who blew off the head of the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, and who himself was killed 2 days later in turn. So this Soviet defector, Nosenko, said, I saw Oswald's file. He wasn't controlled by the KGB. Now, this presented a rather serious problem for the CIA, because if you believe Nosenko, then Lee Harvey Oswald was a nut with a gun who got off a lucky shot and blew off the president's head. But if you didn't believe Nosenko, then the Soviets or the Cubans or both were behind the murder of the President of the United States and had sent this man to mislead the United States. The man in charge of vetting the bona fides of Soviet defectors was a gentleman named James Angleton. Angleton did not believe there was such a thing as a genuine Soviet defector, and many of his allies at the CIA in the Soviet division of the clandestine service agreed with Angleton. So Yuri Nosenko was thrown into Durensvile, into a secret prison for 3.5 years, where he was subjected to conditions that we would call torture, and at the end of the day, it was determined that, in fact, he was telling the truth. Hmm. Thanks, Yuri. Hmm. He got a pension, and he lives this day to the
He lives in the United States.
Yes, he does.
After that time in prison.
Yeah, that was most of the 1960s.
And you wrote a book about Angleton, didn't you?
No, I wrote a book about another CI officer, Alder James.
Oh, Alder James.
Yeah, but you could write an encyclopedia about Angleton.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's get back to our callers. Much more to talk about. We've got George from Willow Grove joining us. George, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is for Mr. Weiner. Mr. Weiner, we're up to almost 4,000 soldiers have been killed in Iraq and almost $1 trillion spent in Iraq. How come we did not order the assassination of Saddam? That would have been easier and more effective than spending all these resources just to get rid of one person.
That's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question.
Thank you, George. It
is one that has confronted directors of Central Intelligence and CIA directors throughout the years. And the only way I can answer it is to answer it the way that Richard Helms, the director of Central Intelligence under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, did. It was not a theoretical matter to Richard Helms. He had been ordered as chief of the clandestine service to murder Fidel Castro. And he says, you know, if you go, there's a practical reason, leaving aside all questions of morality and, you know, the dignity of man and so forth and so on. The problem with this is if you kill some other nation's leaders, why shouldn't they kill yours?
That is an interestingly practical response. So does the CIA engage in assassinations anymore?
The CIA does not technically assassinate foreign leaders because there is still a presidential ban on it, but the CIA, since 9/11, has engaged in a policy known as targeted killings. That is, it will identify someone it believes is a terrorist suspect or a terrorist leader, and then generally using a pilotless drone plane, like a small model plane that is capable of carrying anti-tank missiles, we'll locate this person in a car and blow it to smithereens.
So that's not enough. I mean, they don't call that assassination. What do you call that?
Targeted killing is the term.
Right. But does...
They're not foreign leaders. That's the difference.
Okay. So they might be the head of some terrorist cell somewhere?
They might be.
Right. But we don't know, right? I mean, isn't that part of the problem? knowing what the CIA is or isn't doing?
Well, the way you solve the problem of writing about what the CIA is doing is that you write a book that's entirely on the record,
right,
and that is documented with thousands of endnotes that tell you where your information comes from. That's how I solved that problem.
George, thanks for the call. We've got John now from Newtown. John, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is more directed towards current events and Al-Qaeda. It was ironic because just this morning when I started to listen to your program, I was reading this report from a company called Stratfor. I don't know if your guest is familiar with it.
Very.
It's a private company that analyzes intelligence for governments and, I guess, businesses. And the report is entitled The Many Faces of Iraq. And in it, it discusses basically the current status of Al-Qaeda and that they've been effectively neutralized and isolated. And a lot of these other groups that are carrying out actions today or calling themselves, say, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, really have no direct ties or communication. At least that's what this whole report alleges. And it's basically 100% the opposite of everything I've heard from the Bush administration for the last 5 years. And I'm wondering, can your guests contrast that with the recent report, you know, semi-unclassified, released, stating that Al-Qaeda is stronger than ever?
It's a great question, John. Thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead, Tim Weiner.
You don't hear the president talking that much about Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda these days, in large part because, to be blunt about it, they're not on the run. They are stronger.
And we just talk about Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Right, which is not the same outfit as the Al-Qaeda that attacked the United States on 9/11. They're a completely different outfit. The brand name Al-Qaeda is simply getting a little worn here. Okay, it means the base in Arabic. And the base of people who are willing to kill American soldiers and attack American interests and blow up American embassies and attack forward military bases in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere in this world, and, we fear, attack the continental United States as well, has grown considerably since 9/11. Why? Because we do not have an effective means of projecting our power overseas, and I include diplomacy, as practiced by the State Department, foreign policy, as promulgated by the President, a Congress that oversees and guides diplomacy and foreign policy, and an effective intelligence service that also carries out American foreign policy. We are in a perilous state because the projection of American power throughout the world, which used to be actually welcome in many countries that I have traveled to, including Afghanistan, where I've been six times in the last 20 years, that used to be welcome. We used to be these people's friends. And what happened in Afghanistan is truly a tragedy, and it speaks to the weakness of American foreign policy, American intelligence, American diplomacy, and American leadership.
John, thanks for the call. But I wonder, even the subtext of his question, and I think many people are now very suspicious when there's information, intelligence information, reports coming out that are based on intelligence about Iraq or about Afghanistan or Al-Qaeda. And, you know, the history here doesn't give people a lot of confidence, Tim.
We, as Americans, have to understand that as long as we are projecting power in this world, we have to know what's going on in foreign countries. That is part of the mission of the Central Intelligence Agency. One wants them to succeed in the business of espionage and intelligence analysis. One wants them to be accurate in their reports to the president, because if you don't have intelligence, you cannot make a coherent foreign policy, and you just wind up blowing things up. That is not a coherent foreign policy. Cruise missiles are not the expression of a coherent foreign policy. And it appears as if we are going to have to wait until a new administration takes shape, because this administration, it appears, doesn't have any faith in its own intelligence service. This president asked about the course of events in Iraq and whether the CIA had warned him that things could get awful in a post-Saddam Iraq. Said, well, the CIA said things could be lousy, the CIA said things could be great, they were just guessing, unquote. Just guessing is not intelligence. And when the president says his intelligence service is just guessing about a nation at where we are at war, that's a bad state of affairs.
And you blame the president for that.
I do, and a president whose father, after all, ran the place 30 years ago and after whom its headquarters is named.
Let me get Sam. John, thanks for the call. Sam from Valley Forge joins us. Sam, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask Mr. Weiner whether he had any knowledge about the purge that the CIA and the FBI initiated in Pakistan in the years 1994-1995 time frame, and whether he thinks there's any possible blowback or retaliation that may have been directed against the U.S. as a result of the purge of these so-called Islamists from the high-ranking positions of the then Pakistani internal services intelligence branch and their defense departments.
And Sam, I'm looking at the clock. You're also looking at the computer. You're a former foreign service.
Yes, I served 21 years in the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. That's a law enforcement branch of the U.S. State Department. Okay. I was a former security officer at the U.S. Embassy in 1994-1996 when Ramzi Youssef and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were devising what became the 9/11 attacks, and I was working then under Ambassador Negroponte, who is now the number two man in the State Department. I was the recipient of two anonymous phone calls that named a Pakistani businessman as being part of a plot to kill Clinton, a plot that was acknowledged to have been true by the admission of Ramzi Youssef. But what I suspect is that the U.S. government had initiated a purge of high-ranking Islamists in Pakistan as a result, direct result of this Pakistani's involvement in this plot. Turns out this Pakistani by the name of Tariq Rana was married to a second cousin of Imelda Marcos, and was named as being a close relative of then-day members of Pakistani parliament as well as high-ranking members of the Pakistani military.
Yeah, and
so
Sam, I
want to know, does his book discuss that involvement in the purge and given that Pakistan is so much in the limelight today, I presume that similar further blowback.
Okay, I got to jump in, and I hate to say that we only have about 45 seconds to get an answer from Tim.
What you're describing is a point in a long line of struggle to balance the American role in Pakistan with Pakistan's role in Afghanistan and in the region. We don't have a lot of friends in that part of the world. The leaders of Pakistan today are a military dictator, Pervez Musharraf, who has a tenuous grip on power, and the incredibly powerful Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, which is the military and intelligence units that essentially run the country. If that country blows up, we don't have a lot of friends left in that part of the world. And we would have no choice, probably, but to start another war with another, tens of thousands of exhausted soldiers that have been fighting this long war for 6 years now, and go invade Pakistan, our ally, to clean the place up. Nobody looks forward to that.
Well, much more to talk about. Tim Weiner, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
A pleasure.
And Tim Weiner's book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. A reporter for the New York Times, used to write for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Marty Moscow, and appreciate your phone calls to the show. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.